So you have a pretty busy afternoon. This is not one of those early outs that I promise you will happen eventually. This one takes pretty much the whole time. In fact, you might not even finish, but that's okay today. One of the reasons it's busy is because we're doing two different lab procedures, right? Two and three from the manual. And that is in reverse order of importance, because I think lab two is the corn one, correct? The maize? Okay. Don't even think about that until you've completed lab three's part for today. Lab three takes 5 or 6 weeks, so you don't finish lab three today. But until you get done on today's work for lab three, don't even address the corn stuff. Put it on the back burner. And if you don't finish getting the counts from the corn today, no big deal. We'll get these bins out later on in the term when we have more time. As far as completion of the notebook to be current, in case I check it, don't worry about that either, because you'll get raw data from doing these counts, but you'll eventually be doing some statistical analysis. That doesn't have to be in your notebook until basically the end of the term for lab two, so don't worry about that. Lab three is much more important because this 5 or so week-long experiment needs to be started correctly in order for you to have good and meaningful results, which is important not only because it's so many weeks long, but because you are going to be writing about it. And so whenever you're writing about something, it's a hell of a lot easier to write about it if it went smoothly. And also if you know what you did and why. You understand why, I mean. And that's why I'm going to give you some background information that will hopefully help you understand why you're doing this whole set of experiments for lab three, which is with the Drosophila or fruit flies. So let me just start with some genetic basics. First of all, I want to say that although in everyday usage, colloquially speaking, non-scientifically, we kind of use the words characteristic and trait interchangeably, they are distinct terms in genetics. They have their own meanings. They're not the same thing. And usually the best way of explaining the difference is just by way of example, rather than giving you a definition of each. So I'll use as an example of characteristic eye color, familiar characteristic, okay? Eye color is an example of a characteristic, but for a given population, and by the way, a population is a group of organisms of the same species living together, interbreeding, right? Anyway, for a given population, not all individuals have the same eye color, right? In other words, there's different possibilities for eye color. Well, those specific colors, like hazel, brown, whatever, those are traits of that characteristic. In other words, any given characteristic has a certain number of traits associated with it. And an individual has one of those possible traits. So trait and phenotype are pretty interchangeable. When you talk about an organism's phenotype, you're really describing its trait for whatever characteristic you are studying. All right, that's one important difference. Now, molecularly speaking, a characteristic often corresponds to a gene. In other words, a gene governs or controls a characteristic. So, for instance, for some species, there might be such a thing as the eye color gene, right? So knowing the difference between characteristic and trait, as I just described, if a gene corresponds to a characteristic, what corresponds to a trait? An allele, exactly, because alleles are the variant versions of a given gene. So in a population, whatever gene you're studying might have several different alleles you know, different sequences of DNA for occupying that same locus. The fact that it's at that locus is what makes it that kind of gene. What the actual sequence is depends on which allele of that gene it is. And an individual's trait is going to depend on its alleles, if it's a diploid sexual species, for that one characteristic, right? For that one gene. So keep in mind that sexual species have diploidy. They are diploid organisms, at least during part of the life, sexual life cycle. We spend our adulthood as diploid organisms, for instance, just like the fruit flies do. And what does diploid mean? What did you say? No, a haploid cell has a full set of chromosomes. A full set means the entire library. So all the genes are represented in a haploid cell. But a haploid cell has only one of each kind of chromosome. A diploid cell has two of each kind. And they're not necessarily copies, right? Why are there two to begin with in a diploid cell? Right, one came from the father, one came from the mother. So any given gene that you study, there are going to be two alleles in a diploid cell, or in a diploid individual, right, for that one gene. And this, by the way, explains the three major possibilities. By this, I'm talking about the terminology homozygous dominant, heterozygous, and homozygous recessive, right? That's an exhaustive list of the possibilities with respect to allele combinations, because an individual that is diploid and therefore has exactly two alleles for that gene has to either have both of those alleles be the same, and they're both the dominant type, both of them the same, and both of them are recessive, or they're different versions, in which case it's a heterozygous individual. There's no other possibility for a normal gene that occurs twice. Okay, so those were some basic definitions that hopefully you're already familiar with. Often we categorize genes into two major categories. Some genes we say are Mendelian, named after Mendel, of course, father of genetics, and some are non-Mendelian. That just means that they don't behave in quite the same way as the ones that we call Mendelian genes. So, I mean, it's not that they're different chemically. Any gene is just a sequence of nucleotides, right? But for a gene to be classified as one that behaves in a Mendelian fashion, a Mendelian gene, there are certain assumptions that have to be met, two of which are really important and that I'm going to give you today. One assumption for Mendelianity is that for whatever gene you're studying, and usually we study one or two genes at a time and ignore all the other genes in the organism, but for whatever gene, there are exactly two alleles in the population. Not three or more. Two exactly. And this is exactly what was true for Mendel when he did his famous pea experiments. He used pea plants for all his experiments, but he conducted seven independent experiments using separate batches of pea specimens. Right? In each experiment, he cared about separate characteristics. He didn't know that it was genes. He had no idea what a gene was. But for each of those characteristics, there were exactly two traits possible in the population of plants he used. For instance, when he paid attention in one experiment to seed color only, the only possible seed colors were yellow and green, right? So that's one assumption for a gene to be Mendelian, is that the gene has in the population exactly two alleles, which means that in that population, that characteristic has exactly two traits possible, phenotypically. The other assumption, the other one I'm going to give you today, the major assumption, is that one of those two alleles completely dominates over the other. In other words, there is what is called complete dominance, which is not the only way things happen. There are plenty of examples of what's called incomplete dominance, for instance. But that would be an example of a gene that is non-Mendelian because of that incomplete dominance. All right. Now, what complete dominance means, of course, is that an individual needs only one of the dominant allele in that individual's collection of two alleles for that gene for that individual to completely express the dominant phenotype. In other words, having that second dominant allele, if that individual does have a second one, does not make that person even more dominant in phenotype than a heterozygous individual. Complete dominance means that one is sufficient. And therefore, upon observation, without actually going in and looking at the actual sequence of DNA, just by observing the trait of the organism, a heterozygous individual is indistinguishable from a homozygous dominant individual, right? And keep that in mind, because when you do these fly experiments, you're not going to be looking at genotypes, right? Knowing what a genotype is requires knowing what the actual DNA is. That's the distinction between genotype and phenotype, right? You observe phenotypes. Sometimes you can logically deduce the genotype. For instance, if you know that a gene behaves in a Mendelian fashion beforehand, and you just by observation can see that an individual has the recessive phenotype, then you can, from that information, deduce that that individual's genotype is, for that gene at least, is homozygous recessive, because that's the only way that can happen, right? If it's a Mendelian gene. If it's a non-Mendelian gene, you can't make that assumption. Anyway, those are the two big assumptions we're going to make when we talk about Mendelian versus non-Mendelian genes. Now, in the experiment that you're setting up tonight, that's, I should say, experiments, because you're running two independent experiments. They don't have anything to do with each other, but you set them up more or less identically. The difference in the two experiments is that you pay attention to different genes in the two experiments, or different characteristics, I should say, which correspond to genes. There are three characteristics total, for including both experiments, that you need to pay attention to for these next several weeks in these flies. One of those characteristics is body color. Another is wing shape. And the third is eye color. Now, for the population of flies that we're using, not all Drosophila necessarily, but for the ones we're using, there are only two traits for each of these characteristics. Each of these characteristics has, as one of its two traits, the so-called wild type trait. And wild type is a general term we use in genetics that simply means whatever the trait for that characteristic that occurs in most individuals in a naturally occurring population. So if you actually go out and collect specimens, the trait that you're most likely to see for whatever characteristic you're interested in is the so-called wild type trait. Other traits that are caused because of differences in alleles for that same characteristic are called mutant traits. And individuals that have them are called mutant individuals. All right. Wild type and mutant have nothing, I mean, those words by themselves don't say anything about dominance and recessivity. So in other words, the wild type isn't necessarily the dominant trait. It's just the one that most of the individuals have. Okay, so the wild body type, the wild type body color is kind of a yellowish, lighter color compared to the mutant variety, which you'll be dealing with, which is called black-bodied, self-descriptive. And one important thing to do today is to look at the wild type and the mutant version for each of these characteristics so you can tell the difference. Wild type wing shape is a nice, full, healthy-looking wing compared to the mutant variety you'll look at, which is called vestigial wing. They're much smaller and they're often misshapen as well. So compare the wing shape when you get your flies. And then eye color is the third characteristic. Wild type eye is a nice red color, which is, you know, if you leave your bananas out too long and you get fruit flies in your house, you can see them with the naked eye enough to see that they have red eyes, most of them. Anyway, there's many different mutant eye colors in overall Drosophila, but for the ones we're using, the only other possibility is called sepia-eyed. Sepia is S-E-P-I-A, and you might know that from photography. A sepia-toned black and white photograph is one that's been treated to make it look kind of brownish. That's that sepia color. So sepia-eyed individuals of these fruit flies will have that yellowish or brownish eye rather than the bright red. Okay. So there's three overall characteristics we care about, but only two of those three are cared about in each of the two experiments. In one experiment, you're going to only care about body color and wing shape. In the other one, you're going to only care about eye color and wing shape. Okay? And we'll have to look at multiple generations of these crosses we're going to set up. So you won't get all your answers tonight, but I want to give you the basic kinds of questions that you're eventually going to be able to answer and write about. So these are the long-term goals, basically. One set of questions, I say a set of questions because it's really a separate question for each of the three characteristics, is which of the two traits is dominant and which of the two traits is recessive? Okay, so that's a separate question for body color, wing shape, and eye color. Another basic set of questions is whether any of these genes is X-linked or sex-linked. Those really mean the same thing. And then a third set of questions is whether the pair of genes that you study in one experiment are linked or not. So it's important to distinguish between X-linkage and linkage. They are not the same thing. It doesn't make any sense to ask whether a single gene is linked. When we use the word linked by itself, that really only makes sense when you're considering two genes at different loci, right? The locus is the position that the gene resides at on a chromosome. For two genes to be linked simply means that they have their loci on the same chromosome. They are both part of the same chromosome, in other words. And the reason that's important is because of how meiosis works. In meiosis, you don't have independent assortment of individual genes, right? What independently assort are entire chromosomes. There are multiple different chromosomes within that cell, but an entire chromosome as a unit, carrying however many genes are on that chromosome, go together as a package to one daughter cell or the other. And so they're less free, in a sense, than unlinked genes, which are on separate chromosomes and therefore might go the same direction or might go opposite directions depending on what their chromosomes do. Now, there is actually one way, though, in which two genes that are linked, and therefore reside on the same chromosome, to actually separate from each other during meiosis. What is the process that allows that to happen? Crossing over, exactly. Crossing over involves the formation of a chiasma somewhere along the length of the chromosome, and downstream of that chiasma, the legs of the non-homologous chromosomes are traded, right? Well, even if two genes are linked on the same chromosome, if a chiasma forms between the two loci, then those genes will be separated from each other and go to separate cells. Does that make sense? If a chiasma forms somewhere outside of both of those loci, then they'll still go together as a package. And so there's ways eventually to be able to statistically determine whether the two genes in each of the experiments are linked to each other. By the way, if you have two genes that, you know, let's say one gene is on one tip of the chromosome and the other one is at the other tip of that same chromosome, technically they are linked because they're on the same chromosome. But they're so far apart that almost any chiasma that forms is going to form between them and therefore allow them to separate. So they would behave as though they're unlinked, even though they are technically linked. So that's linkage, totally separate from X or sex linkage. It does make sense to ask whether a single gene is X-linked, even though it doesn't make sense to ask whether it is linked. So X-linkage is determined on a single chromosome by chromosome basis. X-linkage simply refers to the condition in which whatever gene you're studying happens to be on a sex chromosome. Its locus is on a sex chromosome. So this brings up the distinction between sex chromosome and a non-sex chromosome. What are all the other chromosomes that aren't considered to be sex chromosomes called? Autosomes. Right. Now, any chromosome, whether it's an autosome or a sex chromosome, contains a certain amount of genes. The sex chromosomes are so named because there are genes on the sex chromosomes that help determine the sex of the offspring, whereas the autosomes don't. But that doesn't mean that every gene on sex chromosomes are involved in sex determination. There are plenty of genes that just happen to be on this chromosome that also determines sex. So even though the characteristic corresponding to a sex-linked gene might have nothing to do with sex determination, that gene is sex-linked simply because it's on the sex chromosome. And that matters because whether an individual has that trait or not is going to partially depend on what the sex of that organism is, whereas that does not matter for an autosomal gene. So that's your third batch of questions. Is any of these genes X-linked? And you'll be able to look at offspring to be able to tell that eventually. Okay? So you want this to go smoothly as possible, which is why you want to just set it up well tonight. You're not going to be seeing any results because you have to let these things mate. And in 2 weeks when we come back, we can look at offspring. So let me... Well, before I talk about how to set it up well, let me just quickly talk about Punnett squares. A Punnett square, which I have to assume you're all familiar with, at least rudimentarily, is really just a shorthand notation that represents a biological process. What is the biological process represented by a Punnett square? Crossing over is part of meiosis, which has to happen before you even get to being able to form a Punnett square. Meiosis is occurring in an individual, right? Which might not ever actually come into contact with the other individual that you might cross it with. Fertilization, exactly. That is what's represented by a Punnett square. And so before you actually draw a Punnett square, you typically will represent the cross between the parents using genotype terminology, right? A genotype is usually some string of characters, symbols that represent the actual DNA for the gene or genes that you care about at the moment. And for just a general case, gene A, whatever gene A is, it doesn't matter. If we're talking about flies or humans, we could say that you have a cross represented by upper A by lower A. This is not only a cross, but it's an example of what's called a hybrid cross. It's a hybrid because the two parents differ in their traits for the one characteristic that's being studied. A-ness, whatever that is. That's A-ness, not anus. Now, why do these genotypes have two A's in each genotype? Because these individuals are diploid, right? These parents are diploid individuals. They therefore have two alleles, two A alleles, on their two homologous chromosomes with the A locus. Now, you could bother to write this out as a traditional four-box Punnett square, but really, you can hopefully see that there's only one possibility, right? So you can really narrow this down to just a one-box Punnett square, like this. But it doesn't hurt the math any if you bother to write it out exhaustively. In any case, though, because you'll get the same proportions, 100% upper, lower, in other words, 100% heterozygous. But however you set this up, a Punnett square has written to the side of the square and on top of the square genotypes as well. But why do those genotypes have only one symbol in them?
Oh, I was just going to ask a question. In lecture, she typically says that you want to put the male at the top of the Punnett square. Do you care?
I don't care. If she cares, that's fine. But
I just wanted to make sure.
It's actually fine. I mean, it's actually best, in my book, to just explicitly label them with male and female symbols. By the way, what is a female of a species? What's the way that you know what the female is? The female is the one that produces the bigger gamete. They're not always called eggs and sperm gametes, but whatever the bigger one is produced by the female. Anyway, why do these genotypes that you write to the side and to the top of the Punnett square have only one symbol in them? One A in this case. Because they represent gametes. Yeah, and gametes are haploid. Right? So meiosis occurs first. Right? Before there's any mating or not all organisms mate as part of their reproduction. Trees don't mate, but they still are sexual. In any case, before they get together, however their gametes get together, gametes are formed by meiosis, and meiosis randomly chooses one of the two alleles from that individual to include in each gamete. So a Punnett square really is just an exhaustive list of all possible gametes produced by each of those two parents. And when you get row and column together to form combinations of symbols in the boxes, well, what do those boxes represent in the Punnett square? They are diploid genotypes, but what do the squares actually represent, the boxes actually represent? What objects?
Inherited,
Zygotes, exactly. And that's because, as you correctly said earlier, the Punnett square itself represents fertilization. Well, what is fertilization? For diploid adults, sexual adults, fertilization is the union of two unicellular haploid gametes to produce one unicellular diploid zygote, which is how each of you started your lifetime, right? A single cell that has the DNA from both. So Punnett square does not at all tell you how many offspring the parents will have. It doesn't mean there are going to be four offspring, for instance. It just is an exhaustive list of every possible zygote type, paying attention to only that characteristic, ignoring all other characteristics, that those particular parents can produce. All right? And the reason that is statistically useful is because the Punnett square is a predictive device. And that's why once you eventually do the rest of the work for this corn stuff that you'll start today, you'll, for each of the individual boxes, which is a different experiment, you'll be constructing a Punnett square in order to make your predictions as to what those counts should be and see if whether they agree with the counts that you do make. But you'll also be using Punnett squares as part of the fly experiment to make predictions. So this only gives you one possibility, right? 100% of the offspring would be heterozygous in this case. But, you know, if you mate the F1 with themselves, you have heterozygous by heterozygous, and therefore there are going to be four boxes necessary. And you can see that there are going to be three possibilities of phenotype. Right? These two heterozygous individuals are indistinguishable from the homozygous dominant individual if we assume Mendelian genes, complete dominance in other words. So all three of these are one phenotype, this is the other phenotype. Remember, you're not looking at genotype when you look at an organism. So what that Punnett square tells you predictively is that however many offspring those parents have, you expect one quarter of them to be recessive in the phenotype. Have the recessive trait, and you expect three quarters of them to be dominant. All right? Might not turn out that it's going to be 3/4 and 1/4. But that's what statistics are for. A scientist doesn't say, well, this looks pretty close to what I expected, therefore I'm going to say it's true. You need statistics to divorce yourself from the proceedings and be objective as possible, as much as possible. There's all kinds of statistics that we use, of course, for different applications. But the one that we care about in this course is which one? Chi-square. Chi is just a Greek letter. Looks like an X, right? So chi-square equals what? What is the formula? Well, it's a sum, so we use sigma notation, another Greek. It's just a Greek S. It stands for sum. And it's the sum from I equals 1 to N. I is just the index of observance sub I, observed sub I minus expected sub I, quantity squared over expected sub I. So you I takes on a different value each time you go through it until you hit N. N represents what in reality? It is a number, but number of what? Not samples, actually. The number of different possibilities, number of pigeonholes you can put your measurements into, number of categories, basically. For this course, that really boils down to the number of different phenotypes or phenotypic combinations that any individual can have. All right? So in that simple case I gave you, in the last Punnett square I showed you, there were only two categories of phenotypes possible, right? dominant and recessive. And therefore, in that case, N would equal 2. In other cases, especially if you pay attention to more than one characteristic at once, there will be more than 2 possibilities. Whatever N is, though, that's important because that's going to determine how many addends or individual things that you sum together there will be in the overall calculation of the chi-square. Now, observed values are simply your raw data. They are what you count, right? Individuals with the trait in that category are all lumped together. Individuals of the other trait or another trait are lumped together, and so on, for however many categories there are. So that's where they come, that's where those numbers come from, actually observing individuals of a population. Where do the expected values come from? Yeah.
From the ratios you should have.
Where do the ratios come from? Right. The expected values come from a combination of a properly drawn Punnett square. But a Punnett square by itself is not enough because it only tells you proportions, right? Fractions. So you multiply those fractions, 1/4 and 3/4, like in my example, for instance, by the total number of individuals that you observe. So if you observe 108 individuals, then you expect 1/4 times 108, or 27, to be recessive, and all the rest of them to be dominant. That's where the E values come from. Depends on how many you count, and it depends on what the phenotypic ratios are from the Punnett square. Does that all make sense? Okay. So notice the numerator of the summed fraction, the difference between observed and expected. That's really the heart of what chi-square is. Chi-square is a way to quantify how close your observed values come to the expectations. Because if there is no difference, if E equals O, that numerator will be 0, right? A 0 chi-square means you're dead on. You're exactly what you expected. And statistically, what that means is that you have supported the null hypothesis. But if there's a big difference, then that suggests that you should scrap that null hypothesis and say that something else is true. Here's where you can't just decide where you make that transition from accepting or rejecting the null hypothesis. That's where you take it out of your own hands and leave it to just math. And so you have to compare whatever the value is for your chi-square statistic to a critical value. And if you exceed that critical value, if your chi-square is higher than that critical value, then you are justified statistically in saying that that null hypothesis is untrue, or at least not supported in this experiment. Okay? Well, why is it that the numerator is squared? You wouldn't have to square it. You could just have the difference itself. And that would tell you, for each individual category, how much of a difference there is between expectation and observation. Why do you square them? Close, very close. Squaring them forces them to be non-negative. Not necessarily positive, because they could be 0. 0 squared is 0. Any other number besides 0 squared is going to be a positive number in every case, right? The reasons that that's important is that when you sum together positive or non-negative numbers, they will accumulate. They can't undo each other, in other words. So for a simple example, if I have 2 categories and I count 4 total things, and I expect there to be 2 of one type and 2 of the other type, but I actually get 4 of the first type, then I would have 4 minus 2 over 2 for the first category, plus 0 minus 2 over 2, right? Well, 4 minus 2 over 2 is 2 over 2, which is 1. 0 minus 2 over 2 is negative 2 over 2, which is negative 1. 1 plus negative 1 is 0. So the chi-square of 0 would falsely tell you that there is absolutely no difference from what you expected and what you actually got. That's not true, right? You could do either, and they would have the same effect. And there are some statistics that do take the magnitude or the absolute value. But the point is, if you don't do that, then they can negate each other. If they're equal in magnitude but opposite in sign, like this. So you square them, and therefore this turns into 2 squared, which is 4 over 2, that's 2, plus negative 2 squared, which is also 4 over 2. 2 plus 2 is 4. And so the question finally then after you calculate that is 4 high enough? Does it exceed the critical value? Well, there's not just one critical value because it depends on how many categories there are and also on how on what level of confidence you want to have. This is when degrees of freedom come into play, right? And how do you determine what your number of degrees of freedom are? Or is? Yes. Whatever n is, which is the number of categories, it's going to be different for different kinds of experiments. That minus 1 is your number of degrees of freedom. So when you look at a table for chi-square, standard values of critical values, make sure you're looking at the one that corresponds to the correct number of degrees of freedom. And if your computed value is greater than that, then you can scrap the null hypothesis. If it's lower, you have to accept that null hypothesis, given those data. Is all that clear? All right, then let me just end by telling you how to carefully set these up. The flies we're going to be using are in these vials over here. Notice that each vial has a little bit of blue medium in it. You're going to prepare more vials to transfer some of these flies I'll give you into your experimental vials. And there are 2 boxes of vials in here that are intentionally placed almost as far apart as they can be from each other in the room, because you don't want to use the wrong kind of vial. Those food vials are the ones that you should touch tonight and use. Leave these alone entirely. These have been exposed to FlyNap, which is a brand of anesthesia that I'm going to be using to put these flies under so that you can examine them without them flying away and sex them and choose the parents and put them in their vials. Okay? You wouldn't want to start them out in a vial that's going to kill the offspring or the parents themselves. So use clean food vials only and clean foam plugs beside it, which are just the little lids you're going to put into them. These flies are going to be woozy when you put them into your container. They're going to look dead. They're going to be out. They might be twitching. But it's going to take them a while for them to wake up. They'll wake up after you're gone. But if you are not careful and you get them stuck to the moist medium that you put in each vial, then they likely will never wake up, and dead flies don't mate. So you won't have offspring and your whole experiment will be ruined. That's why you want it to be careful. So each group, which is a foursome, there are 6 groups in here, each group needs to make 4 total vials tonight. And preparing the medium is really as simple as mixing instant mashed potatoes. The flakes are really similar. They're just kind of cyan colored rather than white. But you use one of these little cups, leveled off, of the medium flakes, and then an equal amount of water from this jar. You don't have to mix it very much, because you don't want it, you want all this to be down at the bottom of the tube. You don't want to get the medium material slashed around on the walls. Okay? So you want it to be a plug right at the bottom. So keep it upright until it sets up. Doesn't take long, but after several minutes, you'll notice that you can tip it over and it doesn't lose its shape. Once it gets to that point, I want you to tip over all 4 vials and keep them on their side the rest of the day until after you leave. Now, before or after you put the medium in, doesn't matter, but definitely before you deal with any of the flies, make sure you put a piece of tape on each vial and label it completely. The reason you're making four, even though you have two experiments, is because you're going to do each experiment in duplicate. So two vials will be labeled identically, the other two vials will be labeled identically. And you need to have some group identifier, whatever you call your group, should be on that piece of tape. My name should be on there and the start time, so put Tuesday, whatever time we start, I forget. And then you should also label it with the particular cross we're doing. Now you're probably already familiar with one of the multiple standards that genetics uses for genotypes. You're probably familiar with the uppercase, lowercase format, right? Where the letter itself stands for the dominant phenotype. Unfortunately, that's not what we always use. Sometimes we use a letter that actually stands for the mutant version, the mutant trait. But if it's wild type instead of being mutant, we still use that mutant letter and then put a plus superscript on it. Now, what we're going to be conducting are not only hybrid crosses, but dihybrid crosses. So they're still hybrids because the two parents differ in their traits for that one characteristic, but we're going to pay attention to two characteristics at once. That's what makes it dihybrid. And in both cases, both experiments that you're setting up, the females will be doubly wild type, meaning wild type for each of the two characteristics that you pay attention to. So for the experiment that pays attention to eye color and wing shape, the female would be genotypically described as S plus S plus VG plus VG plus. For it to be a true hybrid cross, the parents need to be true breeding, in other words, homozygous. So S stands for sepia, VG stands for vestigial wing, but she is not. She's wild type instead for both of those characteristics, which is why you have the pluses. That's going to be crossed with a male that is SSVGVG. The male is mutant, is sepia-eyed and vestigial-winged. That make sense? The other cross will be exactly like that, except instead of paying attention to eye color, you're paying attention to body color. So it'll be the female will be B+, B+, VG+, VG+, and the male will be BB, VGVG. All right, so have that on your labels as well. You'll have two vials labeled this way, two vials labeled the other way. Have that all complete before you deal with any flies. And then, well, while you're making the media, and it only takes one person from each group to make the media, so don't just en masse go over there and form a big bottleneck. But while you're doing that, I'm going to be putting the flies to sleep. Eventually, you'll be napping them later on, but I want to do the napping today just to make sure that no one overnaps them, because they won't recover from being overnapped. I'm going to try to put them right at the edge so that they have the maximal chance of waking up. So that's why you might see them twitching or even starting to walk away on your index cards. But usually they will last long enough for you to get a good look at them, and carefully, after you pick the two parents, carefully using the paintbrushes, sweep them into the appropriately labeled vials. So make sure you pay attention to the labels when you actually put the flies in. But there's a proper way to do this as well. Like I said, they won't wake up if they get stuck to that medium. So you're going to have to keep a little bit of room between the medium and where you sweep the flies into. But you also need to sweep them in deep enough so that you don't squash them with the foam plug you're going to put in the other end. So carefully sweep them into just the middle of the length of the tube on its side, keeping them away from the blue stuff. And just once it's capped with the foam plug, leave it alone and I'll pick it up later. But after I anesthetize these things, I'm going to come around and give you batches of them to look at. So while I'm doing the anesthetization, you should prepare three little slips of paper that should be sitting out somewhere, or index cards. By your brushes probably is where you'll find them. You need three because there's three different combinations of traits you're going to see examples of. One of them is fully wild type. So just label one of them wild type, meaning that it's wild type in all three of the characteristics. One of them will be black-bodied vestigial winged. So black vestigial. And the other one will be sepia-eyed vestigial wing. So sepia vestigial should be that one. Now the wild type that I'm giving you are supposed to be guaranteed from the company being all females. But the way that they do that, actually sometimes a sterile male can slip through. So expect them to be females, but you still need to look at all of them and make sure they look like a female. It's important today to also get an idea of how to sex these things. So use your pictures in your manual, but there's different ways of doing it. The best way is to flip these things over on their back while they're asleep and look at the abdomen. A female's abdomen comes more of a point, whereas the male is more of a blunt end, and it also has a darker region, the male does. But you'll quickly learn the difference. And anyway, a good example of something that you expect as a female is one of the ones I give you that are wild type. All right? If there is something in the wild ones that look like a male, just don't use that one. But when I give you the two mutant varieties, sepia vestigial or black vestigial, that's going to be a combination of males and females. And you want to make damn sure that you don't use any of those females, because the females that you're going to use are the wild type. So you're going to for each of the two mutant varieties, you're going to separate the males from females, make sure that you have the males in the male group, and use only those together with the wild type females in a vial. Now strive for having at least four of each sex in each vial, which means you'll need at least a total of 8 mutant males, 8 black vestigial, and 8 male sepia vestigial. And you'll need a total of 16 wild-type females for all 4 vials, right? 4 in each. If you have more, that's good. Just depends on how many you actually get from today's batch. If you have more than that, first check to see whether anyone else needs an additional one or two. But if everyone already has 4 and you have more, then just go ahead and put them in your vials. Just make sure they're the right sex and type. Especially females, because if we have more females, we'll have more offspring. The males will just mate with multiple females. But multiple females will mean more eggs, and therefore more larvae and more offspring. All that clear? In that case, I think we can actually get to it now.